On today's program, we hear a recording of Jesse Nippert, Kansas State University professor and grasslands ecologist. Dr. Nippert was sponsored by the Grassland Heritage Foundation to speak last week at Lawrence Public Library about the effects of climate change on the tall grass prairie. But first, the environmental news for the week of 11/19 on Eco Radio KC. My name is Teresa Wilkie. Democracy Now! Reports at least 63 have been killed by wildfires in Northern California, and hundreds of people are missing. A massive cloud of smoke hangs over parts of Northern California. One environmental monitoring group says the region now has the worst air quality in the world. Residents and workers in surrounding areas have been urged to remain indoors. Schools have remained shut since the fire started. Dozens of schools have been closed due to poor air quality. Governor Jerry Brown said the fires were fueled by historic drought exacerbated by climate change. Greenability magazine reports, it's important to switch to energy-efficient lighting. The Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, challenges everyone to switch out at least one inefficient incandescent light bulb for an LED. If every U.S. household replaced just one old bulb with an LED, the NRDC reports that our nation's electric bill would be cut by more than $5 billion, and we'd avoid 2 million metric tons of carbon dioxide pollution in just 10 years. The savings opportunity is huge because the average U.S. household has about 40 lighting sockets, and more than 2 billion sockets nationwide still contain inefficient bulbs. According to the United States Department of Energy, switching to LED lighting in the United States over the next two decades could save $250 billion in energy costs and reduce the electricity consumption for lighting by nearly one half. To learn more, visit the NRDC LED Challenge. Reuters reports the U.S. Renewable Fuel Standard requires refiners to blend biofuels like ethanol into their fuel pool or buy compliance credits from competitors who do. Refineries with small capacities can receive waivers if they prove compliance would cause them disproportional hardship. The EPA, under President Donald Trump, has greatly expanded the waiver program, awarding 29 exemptions for the 2017 calendar year, up from 2016 and 2015. A group representing biofuel companies asked a federal judge to force the EPA to stop exempting small refineries from renewable fuel laws until a lawsuit challenging the agency's actions is resolved. The United States Supreme Court on Friday rejected for now a bid by President Donald Trump's administration to block a trial in a lawsuit filed by young activists, Juliana versus U.S. They've accused the United States government of ignoring the perils of climate change. The Cherokee Tribune and Ledger News reports a state appellate court ruled Friday that the National Fuel Gas Corp could not use eminent domain proceedings to cross a couple's property for the Northern Access Pipeline from McLean County, Pennsylvania, to western New York. The appellate division, 4th Judicial Department, overturned an earlier state Supreme Court ruling which granted eminent domain powers to National Fuel Gas. The property lay in the path of a proposed 97-mile Northern Access Pipeline. The pipeline would move natural gas from the Marcellus shale fields of Pennsylvania into western New York for residential and commercial supplies. EcoWatch reports seasonal spikes of atrazine, a weed killer that disrupts hormones and harms the developing fetus, contaminate the drinking water of millions of Americans at potentially hazardous levels as runoff from corn-growing areas finds its way into source waters and reservoirs. Among the findings of the most up-to-date analysis of national data on the pervasive contamination of drinking water with atrazine, the second most widely used weed killer in America, studies find that elevated exposure to atrazine in drinking water during pregnancy causes preterm delivery and lower birth weight, Studies of people and laboratory animals have shown atrazine and related chemicals harm the reproductive system and disrupt the nerve and hormone systems, affecting one's brain, behavior, and crucial hormones. Reports show Kansas tap water exceeds safe parts per billion, the standard set by the EPA, and Kansas is higher than other Midwest states. Ben Chelsis passed away November 9, 2018. Ben was founder of the Kansas City Food Circle and one of the organizers of the Green Party. Here is a clip of his receipt of the first Ben Chelsis Award from the Kansas City Food Circle.
Thank you for stopping your activity. We are now presenting the first annual Ben Chelsis Grow the Circle Award. In recognition and gratitude of his role in bringing Kansas City Food Circle and Eat Local and Organic Expo into being. Thank you, Ben. And we have the award that's going to be presented now by Catherine and Emily.
I read the song,
okay.
Okay, I'm not going to take much time. Ben Chelsis, this event exists, the local food movement exists in no small part because of Ben's vision, his hard work over the years, and his passion for bringing people into it. And so all of these new young folks, all of these new growers, people coming in, new folks learning how to eat, we owe an immense debt of gratitude to you. So thank you, Ben.
Woo! Thank you so much.
Thank you on behalf of the Food Circle. None of us would be here if it weren't for you. And we want to thank you for having the foresight to get this going. Clearly, it was something we all needed here in Kansas City. And thank you so much. We are all glad to be a part of it.
Thank you.
Okay, if anybody who wants to look at the award can go by the Greens table. If you want me to hold it up, I will.
Give me the flag first.
Okay, I need the
tell them what it is.
And this is a photograph that Linda Hazel takes of Prairie Birthday Farm. She takes amazing photos of her food.
Her own organic peppers.
And she has graciously offered us this photo for Cultivate and Fancy Food Expo to offer to them.
Yes, I
briefly,
do.
You promised for a short time. You know?
Yeah. Go ahead. Look, I've closed your mouth.
Yeah. Well, thank you so very, very much. This is just terrific. But let me say that through the years, I've worked with some terrific people. And I'm not going to name them because for sure I'm going to leave some out. But let me say that the Food Circle idea came out of the green movement, recognizing that everything is interconnected. I think we need to realize that part of our concerns is that the many problems we have are connected, and when we think of solutions, we think that maybe many of them too are connected. And I think we can see that in terms of linking growers and eaters. We could say more about that, but let me say again, thanks to the many persons I worked with, and that we have indeed a tremendous challenge to make for food sovereignty, to be thinking of self-reliance in terms of our food system, so we do not have to be thinking of the huge food conglomerates in the big corporate food industry. So again, thanks again so very, very much.
Hi, my name is Helen Alexander, and I get to introduce Dr. Jesse Nippert here tonight. Jesse is a grassland ecologist who studies the tallgrass prairie. And as I expect many of you know, the tallgrass prairie is essentially our natural heritage. vast grasslands used to exist in this area. Now we have probably only 1-4% at most. So there is a lot of research going on both the remnant prairies and prairie restoration, and Jesse is really a leader in this work. He primarily studies the physiology of prairie plants and how they work in terms of a changing environment. He works over at K-State with the Kansa Prairie near Manhattan. He also is the leader of a large National Science Foundation program there. And he also works in South Africa on grasslands and savannas there.
My pleasure to be here, and I'm excited to talk about Tallgrass Prairie. That's what a lot of my research is focused on. I am associated with the Kansa Prairie, which is a large research natural area that is about 10 miles south of Manhattan, and if you've ever went down Interstate 70, there's a sign there, you can see it. It's about 8,000 acres. So I'm going to talk a little bit about work there, as well as how that kind of ties into some projections for changes here in Kansas. So this top portion here is a section of Kansa. The Kansa has a watershed design where we have boundaries with fire. And that fire really sets a template for sort of how the grassland functions and what species live in the grassland. So the right-hand side of that line is area that's frequently burned, and on the left-hand side is more infrequently burned. And so in addition to talking a little bit about climate change, I'm going to talk a little bit about land use change, because the two really do go sort of hand in hand. So I don't have to talk too much about why we should care about grasslands to this group, but one of the things that we often forget is just how much of the terrestrial land surface is locked up in grasslands. It's roughly 40%. It's the largest biome we have on the planet is our grassland ecosystems. And sometimes we forget about their significance because the mountains and the forests tend to get, you know, a lot of the praises that are sung to them. But up that 40% of the land surface, roughly 800 million people directly derive their livelihood from grasslands. So it's important economically, it's important ecologically, it's important for the recycling of nutrients and biogeochemical cycles, and it's really important for the purification of water and hydrological cycles. So it's a really important biome. We're lucky because here in the Great Plains, we have basically the largest second largest ecoregion after the Serengeti, up in East Africa. The Great Plains is a very large grassland ecoregion. The Great Plains also has a long legacy, basically, of interacting with humans, interacting with the first humans, as well as interacting with humans in terms of our modern agricultural societies. So these grasslands basically paved the way for the development of our continent after, you know, the United States was formed. As we think about these grasslands and their relationship with agriculture, it becomes complex because that Great Plains is divided basically into three different grassland types. We have the Tallgrass Prairie here in the east that we're all familiar with, the Mixed Grass Prairie in the central, and then the Short Grass Steppe in the west. And a lot of our modern agriculture has been based on the development of these grasslands to feed our nation. And so if you like look at the statistics for crops and where they're being produced, this same region of the heartland and the Great Plains is being used for winter wheat, being used for corn, and corn developed, especially in the former Tallgrass Prairie regions. And then, of course, the beef industry is really important, especially here in Kansas. And when you think about the role that agriculture has played and used our grasslands, it's easy to see why so much of it has been lost. So here's a picture of what was the remnant Tallgrass Prairie in that light green, and the dark green shading sort of represents the remnant lands that were left. One of the things that you can notice is that most of the largest tracts of remnant Tallgrass Prairies is in the Flint Hills here in eastern Kansas. So that's where most of it remains. The Flint Hills is also the site of the Kansa Prairie Biological Station. So this is one of the largest grassland research stations here in North America. It has some of the longest legacies of data on fire and grazing and how fire and grazing interact with the Tallgrass Prairie to influence both its structure, so the energy dynamics, the nutrient recycling, the dynamics of water cycling, as well as what species live there. And so a lot of work has been expended over the last 45 to 50 years in terms of understanding prairie dynamics at Kansa. Kansa is an experimental landscape. And what I mean by that is the whole thing is managed like a giant experiment. It's a little over 8,000 acres in size, and it's continuous. And each one of these parcels of land that has a number is either burned at a different frequency or has a different grazing regimen. We have about 350 bison that are in the interior portion of the site, and the entire eastern part of the site has cattle and cow-calf pairs, and we work with the Nature Conservancy to provide information that they then pass on to landowners in the Flint Hills to help with management decisions that help ranchers meet their bottom line and maximize their dollar value, but at the same time provide habitat and conservation benefits for the other organisms that live on this landscape. And so we work with the Nature Conservancy as well as the scientific community to understand how the tallgrass prairie functions. The tallgrass prairie is also interesting because of several different unique characteristics. One is that it's floristically diverse. Just on Konza, we have over 700 plant species of vascular plants. That's quite a bit. And in addition, most of those are forbs. But one of the other things that's kind of interesting about it is of that 700 species, there's basically four that dictate the fate of the prairie. There's four of our warm season grasses, and how they do in a particular year sort of dictates just how much carbon gets locked up into the soil. It impacts things like how severe the fire will be the next year. So while there's a lot of species that live there, there's a few that have an overwhelming impact on the overall dynamics of that system. We also have an incredibly diverse bird populations of both residents and migrants that come through, and then all kinds of other vertebrates and countless species of invertebrates that live on site. The other thing that's unique about Konza is we have a forest and stream corridor where we have gallery forests that represent our eastern deciduous species. We have restored agricultural fields, and then there's been quite a lot of work on terms of understanding the dynamics of headwater prairie streams, these streams that used to be a lot more common than they are now. But if you think about Konza, Konza is really a story about fire, in my opinion. As a burned landscape, we use fire to manage the system, but we use fire to understand the dynamics of the system, to understand how fire interacts with grasses to impact things like growth, to impact things like the carbon that's going into the soil, to impact things like the diversity of other species that are present. So this is really a story of understanding how fire and prairie go hand in hand. The reality is without fire, you don't have prairie. You don't have tallgrass prairie in the absence of fire. The two things must co-occur. The same thing happens actually with grazers too. You must have grazers, you must have fire, because if you remove fire from the system, it quickly transitions into a shrubland. It's not a stable community in and of itself. It requires fire. And this is a landscape that's had fire on it since the beginning. So, you know, when we think about Kansas as grasslands, this is fairly recent in geologic time. It's only over the last 10,000 years that this has been a grassland system. And fire has been present that entire time, whether it started accidentally by lightning or whether the first humans basically used it as a management tool to move animals around on the landscape. When you burn frequently, this is what it looks like. That's a sea of warm season grasses. This is one of my favorite spots. I'm not really a botanist, I'm an ecophysiologist, and so I study carbon and dynamics. That's not floristically diverse, it's those big four grasses, and they've kind of muscled everybody else out, and ooh, I love it, because I don't have to learn tons of different species. So that's one of my favorite spots. So Konza is an experimental landscape. So this is a cross-section where a bunch of these different watersheds come together, and if you look at different times of year, you see different patterns on the landscape as a byproduct of fire. And so fire plays this important role in terms of structuring the overall ecosystem. Konza Prairie is also unique because we're part of a collection of long-term sites that are collecting the same types of data in the same way year after year after year. So in the early 1980s, the National Science Foundation set out to start archiving data to understand basically how different ecosystems work. And they wanted to collect long-term data so that over time, not only would we understand how they work, but we could predict what might happen in the future. Turns out that was a pretty prescient undertaking. And this system, this cohort of sites has grown from 6 originally to now it's nearing 30 that are spread out all over North America, as well as a couple in Antarctica and one in French Polynesia. And so Konza was one of these original sites that was set out by the National Science Foundation. And we're coming in on our 40th year of collecting data as part of this program. So when we originally set out, a lot of the missions of being a part of this program and a lot of the data collection effort was just focused on understanding how the system works. We just wanted to understand sort of what makes a tallgrass prairie and how do we keep it that way. So a lot of the first funding that was associated with this and the original research projects were focused on understanding how climate, changes in fire and grazing, and changes in alterations of nutrient availability impacted the dynamics of the system. So this was roughly about the first 15 years of funding from the National Science Foundation was set towards understanding this task. And as we moved forward, one of the next things that we did is we realized that in the mid-1990s that there were changes that were happening. Those changes could be changes in land use, those changes could be associated with the climate, and those changes could be associated with changes in nutrient alterations through nitrogen deposition, so nitrogen in particulate form that's in the atmosphere that comes down into a system and serves to almost fertilize the landscape. So we started adding on these layers of complexity over time. So the next three funding cycles basically were focused on trying to not only continue to understand the dynamics of the system, but understand how these global change drivers also then worked to alter the dynamics of the system, which worked to alter what species were present and how things grew, and then more importantly to start to think about how can we predict what's going to happen in the future. Our current funding cycle, these are a six-year funding cycle from the National Science Foundation, is built on this template of the previous work, but now it's focused on understanding different alternative ecological states, so different trajectories that the system can move to. This gets impacted by different things like the invasion of invasive species. This is Caucasian bluestem, absence of fire, and a transition into a woodland. With infrequent fire, you can get shrubland ecosystems, and then sort of the native ecological states that you can have based on the presence of grazers or the absence of grazers. So this trajectory of understanding different ecological states that can potentially exist within the same system. So it's a new way of thinking about this platform of the original system dynamics, as well as global changes and how they are sort of dictating all the possible trajectories that one ecosystem can have. So we have this tall grass prairie, but basically it can transition into so many other things. And so that's what a lot of our work is focused on right now. So based on that as a template of a lot of the work that we're doing at the site, I thought I would spend most of the time today talking a little bit about some of these direct impacts of global change on our system, what we've learned so far, what we don't know, and where we kind of hope to go in the future. So when we think about direct climate impacts, I have them in that sort of left-hand column over there. The biggest one that we think about is changes in precipitation. So when I think about climate, it's typically a story about changes in precipitation and changes in temperature. So changes in temperature, we're all fairly aware about. It's changes in the average daytime temperature. Some of the other things we tend to not think about that are equally as important, if not more so, is changes in nighttime temperature. Warmer evenings have big impacts on the communities that experience them. The other thing is a change in winter, changes in warmer winter. For those of us who've lived in Kansas most of our lives, or you've heard like your parents or your grandparents say, well, back in my day, we had snow and it was knee deep. I've got news for you, if you're a younger person, they're correct. We used to have a lot more snow than we do now. It's not just that mom and dad or grandma and grandpa forgot what the heck they were talking about. Like, that's actually true. We've had these transitions towards warmer winters, and it's been manifest in a variety of ways. There are also these indirect effects of climate change. CO2, as it goes up in the environment, as Ken nicely pointed out during his talk, has a variety of impacts. One of the things you don't think about, though, is of the plant communities. Plants, of course, use CO2 as their substrate for photosynthesis, but it impacts plants differently. Those warm season grasses basically don't benefit nearly as much from elevated CO2 as the cool season plants do. Cool season plants grow faster, they use water a little bit more efficiently, and they have more of a positive impact from elevated CO2 than our warm season plants. We also have nitrogen coming in, like I said, nitrogen deposition that's carried in the atmosphere. It tends to get deposited here in the Great Plains. And then this big one here at the bottom, there's a lot of land use and land cover change. As Kansas has become more populous, as we've fragmented the landscape, and in greater extent, that has impacted the woody species that exist here in Kansas and in other portions of the Great Plains. So I'll mostly focus on a few examples from a few of these different categories. So one of the big impacts of climate change is a change in precipitation intensity. So a lot of the forecasts for this region of the Great Plains aren't necessarily a change in precipitation amount in terms of total amount. We're expected to get roughly the same amount of rainfall in the future that we get now. That there's going to be changes with it. And a lot of it is supposed to come in these more intense packages. So the intensity of rainfall is coming up. This is a plot showing, you know, over time how changes in rainfall intensity. So that 1% of rainfall events in a given year that tends to be intense are supposed to happen with greater frequency. Here's a broken out for different ecoregions of the United States. One of the things that you can see is as we went through time, that change in greater frequency of intense storms, so storms, you know, roughly greater than 2 inches or more, they're going to happen with more frequency. But if we're not changing the total amount of precipitation in a given year, but you're getting more of these big storm events, that means you must be having a lot more dry periods in between storm events. So we're not changing the total amount, we're changing how that rainfall is delivered from less small events to more of the greater events. This is a pattern that's seen broadly across the United States, but especially here in the Great Plains and down in the southeastern portion. One of the other things that we're seeing is we're getting more of that winter precipitation as rainfall, as I noted. This is a graphic that I came across the other day. Kansas has elaborate meteorological records that exist. In fact, Manhattan, Kansas has the longest daily records of any location west of the Mississippi River. We have daily temperature records that go back into the 1880s. But when we think about all of these meteorological stations that could exist across the state, one of the things that helps us look at through time is changes in climate. And Kansas is basically the state that has the fourth greatest change in terms of water going from snow in the winter to rain in the winter. So we're getting more of our winter, of our precipitation that happens in the winter as coming in the form of rainfall as compared to snowfall. We also have changes in other aspects of temperature. And this is one that came out from the National Climate Assessment from a few years ago. And this is projected number of change in hot days. So what this means is from the years 1970 to 2000, they took the seven hottest days on average for any given year. And then for a particular region over that 30-year time period, they have it marked there. And then using two different climate scenarios for the future, one that's a best-case scenario and one that's not the best-case scenario, we started thinking about what's that change in the number of hot days that are going to exceed the current hottest 7 days of the year. And even under the best-case scenario, you're looking at roughly 2 weeks of additional warmer days from the years 2140 up to from 2040 to 2070, so the latter half of this century. One of the other things that's been kind of interesting to think about that kind of hits home here in Kansas is Kansas has the 100th meridian. So the 100th meridian is this line that runs through the eastern part of the state of Kansas. For those of you who are familiar with western Kansas, it goes right through the city of Waukini. And this 100th meridian used to be called the dry line. And the dry line was a line that basically was denoted by John Wesley Powell when he was exploring for the federal government in the mid-1800s. But he noticed that when he went past this meridian, we changed into a different climate zone, the drier of the west compared to the wetter of the east. And this was sort of a zone that demarked basically where you lost more rainfall to evaporation than you took in precipitation. One of the things that's been interesting is over the last century, the functional significance of this dry line has been moving east. So instead of being located in Waukini anymore, it tends to be located more with Manhattan, Kansas, and other regions like that. So this dry line has been moving such that it's been shifting east through time. And so this is just another sort of indicator for thinking about how these changes, how we see them slowly taking place on our landscape. We can also think about this in terms of when we think about climate zones. Whenever you go and buy plants, you think about growing plants in your garden, a lot of times they will be demarked with sort of the climate zones where they're going to do the best. That is sort of, those zones have been set forth based on thinking about the minimum winter temperature. So that's how those zones basically get established. And one of the things that's also been changing through time is those are migrating northward. So the zones basically is how we think about plants and where plants are going to succeed in terms of growth for the plants we want to cultivate. That's been sort of also changing. So just in the last couple of decades, we've already lost basically a half of these climate zones. Then the biggest thing that hits home, at least up for us here in Kansas over the last few years, are changes in droughts and deluges. So as we go through these periods of droughts, then we go through these periods of floods. This is becoming more frequent. This is a combination of a variety of factors. Elevated CO2 plays a key role in this. As it warms the air temperature, warmer air can carry more water. As warmer air can carry more water, it can deliver more of that water at any given particular time. So when it does rain, we tend to get these big rain events. And in the meantime, when it isn't raining, we tend to set up this reinforcing feedback such that when it's dry, it tends to stay dry. So we go through these periods. But the increased frequency and intensity of these periods of rain and dryness are what's projected to happen in the future. And we all know through experience that we experience this with greater frequency now than we used to. So one of the last slides that I have kind of talking about some of these climate change impacts is this one on changes in consecutive dry days. Similar to the one that I had on the hottest days on record, this basically also was from the years 1970 to 2000. And what they did basically for every given point is look at what's the average number of days without rain for a given particular region. So here in eastern Kansas, we're looking at somewhere between 25 to 30 days on average in a given year where we didn't have any rainfall at all. We look at these different model forecasts for the future. You can see that areas that used to be wetter here in eastern Kansas going all the way down to East Texas and the Gulf are really, the forecasts for both scenarios are such that we're adding potentially 3 to 4 more days on top of this sort of 25 to 30 day period in terms of extending the number of days without rainfall. Again, the forecast, though, is the same total amount of rainfall for a given year. So if we're having these prolonged, extended dry periods, that rain's got to come sometime. When it comes, it's probably going to come in big events. So that's how we think about changes in precipitation pattern. We think about all of these scenarios. We think about their impacts. But it's easy to sort of lose sight that there's a cost to this. There's the ecological cost, but there's a financial cost. We're an agricultural state, and the changes in agricultural losses impact the economy of the state. This is just from a few weeks ago in terms of indemnities. They keep track, basically, of indemnities on a county-by-county basis. There's an ecological cost to this change. There's also this financial cost to this change. The other thing that's interesting about this is we remember these legacies of these changes in the past. The great droughts of the 1930s is something that's cemented in the legacy of our state. Thinking about the consequences of those great droughts, that was predicted when it happened, and then as climatologists have looked back on that 10-year period of drought, it was considered to be a once-in-every-1,000-years thing. Like, that's how basically the significance and periodicity of those great droughts. But the forecast for the future is that these 1-in-1,000-year potential events are going to start happening with like a 1-in-100-year periodicity. So the forecasts are that they're potentially going to be happening with a lot more frequency. So when you're at a biological station, though, you can try and understand how some of these things are impacting the system in its current state. So the hydrological cycle, basically, in the Tallgrass Prairie that we study at Conn's Prairie, when we think about it, rainfall that comes in, basically, most of it is lost to transpiration, so it's lost as evaporation through the leaves of the plants rather than bare soil evaporation. We don't tend to have a lot of runoff for the most part, and then rainfall that happens in the winter does tend to infiltrate, and that's what serves as a form of recharge in our system. But when we think about changes in some of these patterns and forecasts that I've already discussed, if you're getting more of the water coming in these very large events, you're going to get more runoff than you have now. And if you're getting more runoff than you have now, that's going to be less total water that's available to recharge the system, less total water that's available either for humans or for the other organisms that rely on the prairie system. In addition, if you're having hotter days and a greater period of time between rainfall events, more of these hotter days, it's going to result in more evaporation. The plants are going to have to close the pores in their leaves in which they recycle water from, and so that's going to result in more of the water being lost and not actually being used by the vegetative community. So there's the forecast for some of these different events to take place. One of the things that's great, though, is you can design experiments to test this. You can put together experiments like these shelters from one of my graduate students here that are very simple and very cheap and start to understand, basically, as I remove water from this system, how's the prairie going to respond? And a lot of work at Conza over the last 25 years has been focused on doing this. So this is a snapshot of a bunch of different experiments that have been done at Conza Prairie, as well as some of the other grassland sites in the mixed grass prairie and the short grass steppe further west, in terms of understanding how changes in climate, whether it's a reduction in overall rainfall amount or whether it's a change in pattern, how that's going to overall impact what species live there and the overall dynamics of the system. One of the things, though, that you want to make sure is if you're designing a climate change experiment, that the impacts that you're imposing are actually somewhat relevant to the long-term history. So one of the things that we're lucky to have is roughly 40-some years of detailed climate history of the site, as well as detailed knowledge in terms of how much grass grew in this year, what type of grass was it, how was it allocated between flowers and other types of leaves. We ask all kinds of boring questions and collect all kinds of boring data that's freely available online for all kinds of other people to ask boring questions and do things with. Well, they're not boring to me, of course, they're just boring to my wife and lots of other people. But one of the things, though, that we can do is using all this long-term data, see if the changes that we see in terms of this response axis here, AMPP, you can think about that as above-ground biomass produced in a given year. So changes in above-ground biomass in a year based on changes in growing season precipitation. One of the things you'll see here is the blue line represents what we've observed over 40 years, and the red line it represents those changes based on experimental manipulations. The fact that the slope of those lines is very similar suggests that the way we're manipulating the climate in terms of growing season precipitation with our experiments matches sort of what we've seen over this multi-decade approach of collecting data. So based on that, we can start to design big experiments. One of the first large climate manipulation experiments that was ever done in any grasslands started in the late 1990s at Conzen. It was called the RAMPS, the Rainfall Manipulation Plots. So they were these large shelters with plastic that went over them. They had a suspended sprinkler system, like an above-ground irrigation system. So it would rain, the water would come in these tarps, it would be stored in these black tanks. We'd turn on a valve for a pump, and then we could basically make it rain underneath those shelters whenever we wanted. So one of the things we could do is we could keep the total amount of rainfall constant, same amount of rainfall, and just change the variability. So we would just basically extend the number of dry days. This project went for nearly 2 decades, and there was a lot of information that was gleaned from it. It's almost a disservice to just show it in one slide, but this is basically one shot slide showing some of those changes. And the biggest thing that we saw, so in this case, these open circles right here are the ones where same total amount of rainfall, we just increased the variability. We're just making bigger events that happen less frequently. And even though they're getting the same amount of rainfall, this again was the annual biomass produced in a given year above ground. You can see that there was consistently less biomass produced, even though they're getting the same amount of rainfall, but based on climate change projections, there's considerably less biomass that's being produced. That's less carbon in the system, that's potentially less grass for your livestock. So there's significant impacts just by altering the variability in the system. Following up from this, we implemented a series of projects. This one's called the Climate Extremes Project. And in the Climate Extremes one, one of the things we do is we impose these droughts such that it's basically a 60% reduction. And we all know that droughts cause reduced biomass, but what we wanted to see was this cycle of drought and recovery, drought and recovery, drought and recovery over time to see, does the grassland have a memory? Does it remember the previous drought cycle, and does it impact how much basically biomass then grows even when you give it the full amount of water? And as you might expect, I think I probably gave away the punchline there, it does remember. And so one of the things you can see here again is the same idea. So the red here is a drought cycle, and then in the recovery years following the drought, the first time around, they basically return the same biomass. But in subsequent years when we've done this, they basically don't. And the same thing holds below ground. When we start to look at the amount of biomass that's being produced below ground as well, one of the things you can see is in droughted areas that were then droughted a second amount of time, the amount of root biomass that's being produced is considerably lower than the ones that was just droughted for the second time. So there's this memory effect in drought in the system. So when you start to think in the future and you start to think about subsequent and chronic events stacking up one on top of the other, you're likely to get different impacts than if it's just a single event by itself. So here was the final recovery one from the above-ground biomass, and one of the things you can see here is this one that had been droughted more than multiple times. Even when it's given full amount of water, it's got a considerably lower amount of biomass compared to the ones that hadn't experienced multiple subsequent drought. So some of the results from some of these climate change experiments that we've done is that changes in rainfall frequency impact the community in a very similar way to just a reduction in overall amount. So even though they're getting the same amount, changing that pattern has a big impact on the system. The resilience, or basically thinking about the integrity of that system through time, it tends to decline following these extreme events, meaning that you can expect changes in the total number of species that live there, as well as which species live there. There's a change basically in the dynamics of the community. So it's not just about the amount of biomass that's being grown, it's also which species will tend to live there. And then in addition, those impacts on changes in which species are there tend to impact the responses of diversity in the system. And these responses on diversity, whether it's plant diversity or insect diversity or other aspects of the whole ecosystem level of diversity, they might differ from impacts on function or just the amount of total carbon that gets locked into the system. So these ecological consequences might actually vary through time. So I have a couple more minutes, but I wanted to shift slightly away from climate change to one other large threat to grasslands in Kansas that is a byproduct of changes in global change and land use, land cover change, and that's woody encroachment. And these are mostly pictures. Sometimes it's a little bit more meaningful when you see visual images. So we put in a large weir for understanding changes in water dynamics on Kansas. I wasn't there in 1985, but folks at Kansas put it in 1985. So this is just following the construction of this weir. Here's a picture of that same weir about 30 years later, and it's completely covered now in trees and all kinds of woody plants. One of the things that's been interesting about Kansas is John Briggs and other folks who have worked there have taken a lot of detailed measurements on the ground using GPS to sort of mark where these woody plants are. Here's three watersheds, one that's burned every year, every 4 years, and one that we consider to be unburned. It's just burned every 20 years. You can see when it's burned every year, there's really no change in woody cover. The black shading indicates woody species. Every 4 years is turning into a woodlot, and every 20 years is similar as well. And so through time, this change basically in the amount of woody species that are present is impacting the system. This is what I meant by earlier when I said a change in ecological state from a grassland to a shrubland to a woodland. You have a change basically in the characteristics and dynamics of the system. We can also measure this using all that long-term data that we collect on the site. So here's year through time, shrub cover. These are those same three pictures that from that previous slide, burned every year, every 4, and every 20 years. And you can see for a long period of time, there's really no change at all in terms of the woody cover. And then you get what's called like a tipping point. And that ecosystem then quickly transitions into a new one. So in this case, the open circles are every 4 years of fire, and this is every 20 years of fire. But you can see that around the years 1999, 2000, 2001, we start quickly transitioning into a different system. And this is for roughleaf dogwood, and this is for eastern red cedar, where we're seeing similar dynamics. One of the things that's been interesting and fun for me as I've run my lab is to figure out why. Why is this happening? Like, what is accelerating this shift? In case of the shrubs, one of the things that happens is as they age and they get bigger, they can escape fire. But more importantly, they produce less flammable fuel. And so the leaves that fall down beneath them quickly decompose, and then when we run a fire through in the spring, they've insulated themselves from the negative consequences of fire. Grasses require fire. The fire is what keeps the grassland healthy. It's what promotes the existence of the grasses. But the woody plants tend to get damaged by it, especially eastern red cedar. But one of the things that's unique about the dogwood is as it ages, it produces less herbaceous fuel. You can see this, again, through pictures. So this is from one of those long-term unburned watersheds. So you can see the eastern red cedar. All this is dogwood without its leaves in here. So this hadn't been burned in about 22 years. We ran a fire through in the spring of last year. And so this is the first day. Here's us lighting the fire. You can see it was a pretty windy day. We were waiting for a good day to try and get that fire to carry into the watershed. This is immediately after the fire. And here's a couple days later. So this is less than a week later. We waited for about the worst conditions that we could get in terms to carry that fire into that watershed. And you can see that for the most part, it was relatively unimpacted. In fact, these polygons represent where the roughleaf dogwood is. You can see the fire didn't even penetrate at all. This is one of the worst, windiest days we could possibly burn, and it had no impact whatsoever on them. And then in addition, this eastern red cedar, which is very susceptible to fire, you can see it sort of dotted here on the landscape. We went out and marked it, and by we, I mean one of my students. And one of the things that they realized is that through doing this, is roughly only 25% of them were killed. And so this is a very stochastic process. And once these plants get established, it's very difficult to actually remove them. And these have several different consequences in terms of the amount of biomass that's going, where it's going. Grasses put most of their biomass below ground. Woody plants tend to keep most of it above ground. In terms of other aspects of the system, but especially in terms of species richness. So which species are there? Grasslands are a species-rich ecosystem. There's all kinds of other different species of plants that exist among the grasses. But as you transition into a shrubland or a woodland, you lose most of those species. It changes the characteristics of the ecosystem. So this woody encroachment is a significant concern to us because here in the Flint Hills of Kansas is where we have most of the remaining tall grass prairie that exists. And yet, if we actually use aerial maps like this to look at how frequently it burns, a lot of it isn't being burned very frequently, even though in the spring, of course, there's just smoke everywhere, and we're all like, oh my goodness, there's so much smoke because of all the burning in the Flint Hills. The reality is a lot of it's being burned on a rotation that's greater than 3 years, and our work at Kansas Prairie shows that that's susceptible to these woody transitions, this loss of the ecosystem through woody plants coming in. So when we think about climate change and we think about the consequences, there's many different aspects of this. It's more than just warming temperatures. It's more than just changes in precipitation pattern. It's all these other aspects, changes in nutrient dynamics, changes in land use and land cover change, and they're all interacting. And so as we think about managing systems, we need to keep this broader holistic perspective, how we think about managing the grassland, and how we look for solutions. Because this is a global problem, but we're all concerned about local environments. And there's a lot we can do, but we need to sort of keep this broader perspective and realize there's a lot of interactions in, amongst all of these direct and indirect impacts of climate change. So this is the last slide that I have in terms of what can we do about this? And this is hopefully something we can talk a little bit about in the question portion after all of this. But there's a lot of things that we can do. A lot of it's just coming to things like this, talking to other people who are concerned about this, looking for creative ways and solutions to maintain what we have. As Kansans, these grasslands are our legacy. I mean, this is who we are. We're the people of the plains. Like, I'm very proud to be from Kansas. I'm not always super proud of the decisions that Kansans make, but I'm very proud to be from Kansas. And these grasslands, I mean, this is our heritage. And so working together, talking to other folks, and coming up with creative solutions to protect what we have is very important because this is a tremendous ecological and cultural legacy that we have here. And it's something to quite honestly be very proud of. So I'm going to end it there. Nobody works alone. I have a great team of people that I work with. I have amazing students. A lot of the data that I've shared with you was collected by other scientists at the Kansas Prairie. But I appreciate you being here, and thanks a lot.
That was Dr. Jesse Nippert speaking at the Lawrence Public Library, sponsored by the Grassland Heritage Foundation. Earlier this month, he spoke on climate change and the tall grass prairie. Now the calendar of events for the week of November 19th. Kansas Sierra Club announces a change of name for grants. The Kansas Sierra Club Environmental Grant Program is now called the Ed Rau Environmental Grant for Primary and Secondary Teachers. For more information, go to kansas.sierraclub.org. On 11/23, 1 to 4 p.m., instead of going out for Black Friday, step out into nature. Learn about how accessible nature in the city can be with the Heartland Conservation Alliance Youth Council. The Opt Outside campaign was started 4 years ago because spending time outdoors is important for physical and mental health. There will be a 2-mile hike led by local environmental professionals filled with information about local trails. Contact Heartland Conservation Alliance, 4750 Troost, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. On 11/24, two shifts are available, 9:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. or 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. at Red Bridge Recycling Center, located at 5200 East Red Bridge Road, Kansas City, Missouri. Minimum age 8 with parent, volunteer alone at 14 years. All volunteers must register in advance. Call or text Amy Smith at 816-561-1062 or email volunteer@bridgingthegap.org, mentioning your preferred location and volunteer date time. These items and more can be viewed on the Eco Radio KC Facebook page and at the kkfi.org Eco Radio program page.